Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of my favorite authors in recent years is Natalia Holt. Two of her books in particular, The Rise of the Rocket Girls, that tells the story of the women who helped propel the United States to the moon and the planets and beyond from the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, and The Queens of Animation, which tells the story of the women animators at the Disney Studios, were favorite reads in recent years. Her latest book is an amazing story of adventure and conservation set in the late 1920s. Titled The Beast in the Clouds, the Roosevelt brothers' deadly quest to find the mythical giant panda tells the story of President Theodore Roosevelt's two sons, Theodore Jr. and Kermit, and their expedition to the Himalaya to find and kill a giant panda for a natural history museum. At the time, the panda was so little known in the West that many doubted they even existed. And spoiler alert, they do shoot and kill a panda. But it's the story of what led up to that tragic moment and the aftermath that's fascinating and an important story in the history of wildlife conservation. Natalia joins us now to talk about it. Natalia Holt, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we talk about this new book, I'd kind of like to go back and talk about your career as a writer, because you've written some really interesting books on some topics that I've particularly enjoyed. What first got you interested in writing?
Yeah, you know, I've always loved writing ever since I was a kid. I love to read. I love to write. And then I never expected to be a writer. I have a PhD in molecular biology and worked in the lab and worked in science for a very long time. And then eventually I just decided that there was a story I really wanted to tell. It was work that I had done during my PhD. And it was a story about HIV and about what it means for gene therapy and how these gene therapy trials are impacting science today. And so I wrote that book never really expecting to write any more. And I've just been so fortunate to keep finding these stories in history and science and unexpected people that have just done incredible things. So I feel like I've been very fortunate in finding these stories and getting to write about them.
And one of the questions I get asked a lot, and I'm going to ask you the same question, is like, how do you come up with the topics, you know, for your show or who you're going to talk to? And my answer is usually very simple to that. It's like, if I'm interested in something, then I think I'm going to make it interesting for you too. That's, you know, it's got to be interesting to me. If I'm fascinated by it, then, you know, I'm pretty sure my listeners are going to enjoy it. Our listeners are going to love it too. So I'm curious as to what led you to choose this latest book project, because it was something I was really completely unaware of. Tell me how you decided to get into the Roosevelt brothers, Theodore Jr. and Kermit, and the story of their expedition to China and Tibet to search for the giant panda.
Well, you know, it wasn't easy. When I first wanted to write this book, my editor said, "This isn't what you do. You write about women in history. Give me one of those books. I don't want to read this one." But I think I'm like you.
Let me stop you right there, because you saying that was something I was thinking about this earlier, that I was kind of like, you know what? I'm proud of you for doing that, because I wouldn't want you to get pigeonholed into, like, you know, typecast, as you will, that, oh, well, you just do books on women. I'm glad you got a different topic, because I thought this was very fascinating, and, you know, you did it well. So good for you.
I appreciate that. And I love writing about women. But it is fun for me to be able to look at all kinds of different people who maybe accomplish things that you don't expect and who have been overlooked by history. And I do think that I'm quite a bit like you in that I write the stories that I want to read, that I'm really interested in. And for me, when I'm selecting a topic, I know that I'm going to be researching this topic for a minimum of 5 years. So it's really a process for me to commit. I mean, I really have to decide that I'm going to spend the next 5 years committed to this project. And it's a big thing. But for me, this story was so important to tell. It's interesting. It's an exciting history. There's a lot of adventure. There's also a lot of science. And there's a lot to be said for what it means for conservation and biology and these big picture ideas. I also really love diving into Roosevelt history It's a slice of history that I've always been fascinated by. And so to be able to look at Teddy Roosevelt through the eyes of his sons was so interesting for me.
How did you get interested in this particular story? Because I was unaware of this expedition.
Very few people are aware of this expedition. It is not a story that has been told very often. And how I got into it is when I was researching a previous book, I was looking into Kermit Roosevelt, who was a CIA station chief in the Middle East during World War II. And a funny thing when you're researching the Roosevelts is that so many of them have the same name. And so, you know, there's Ted, there's Kermit, there's Quentin, there's these names that you hear over and over again. And so as I'm researching this one Kermit Roosevelt, I realized that his father was also in World War II at the same time. And that's kind of how I ended up going down this road of finding out about Kermit Roosevelt and this expedition he took. And I was really struck by the fact that the panda hadn't been discovered at that time and that people really knew so little about this animal as late as 1928.
Well, yeah, that was really struck me as I didn't know that people were unaware that the panda existed. It was some kind of mythical beast. But the Chinese, you know, going back for centuries and centuries, they were aware of it, right?
It's interesting when you look at the history of China, because this is such a big country. And in the book, I talk a lot about the cultural groups that live in China and how separated they were. And so you have these regions, these isolated mountainous regions where the panda lives and where people there know quite a bit about the panda. But because they're so remote and they have so little contact with others in China, particularly scientists and naturalists who lived and worked in China, nothing was known. There was no exchange of information within the country. So while people knew, of course, about pandas to a limited extent, it wasn't well known in the country and there hadn't been studies done. People weren't aware where this animal lived, what it ate, whether it was actually a bear. These were the basics that were disputed. And in fact, for Western scientists, many of them were skeptical that the panda was real at all because it had been such a long search to find this animal.
And wasn't there one person that brought back a skin or something and before this expedition and kind of confirmed that there was the panda? And people looked at it and saw that, you know, the black and white coloration of the panda that we know so well now, they just didn't believe it, right?
Exactly. So there are a few skins that were sent to the West from China. The first was from a French missionary in 1869. And so he received a skin of a panda cub. And he really doesn't know much about the animal, but he sends it to this museum in France who looks at it and has a really hard time wrapping their brain about what this could be, what animal this is. The missionary is able to give an explanation, but it's lacking in details. And of course, there's only so much you can tell from the hide of an animal. It doesn't give you that much information. And then in the early 1900s, a group of German explorers went to bring back the panda, and they also had a lot of difficulty. They weren't able to find a panda themselves. They were able to get some other hunters to go out looking for them. But once again, nothing is returned to museum and scientists where this can really be studied. And then in 1919, an American missionary in China sends another hide from a panda, this time to the American Museum of Natural History. And this hide is larger, it's more intact. And so the scientists get more excited now because they're starting to believe, okay, this animal is likely real and we need to go find it. We need to discover what this bear actually looks like, where it is, what it eats. And all of these expeditions go off into China. And that happens for the next 10 years. No one is able to find the panda. No more hides are returned to museums. And it's just this blank space. Nobody really understands what's happening and why it's so difficult to find this bear. And so when the Roosevelts leave for this expedition in late 1928, no one is really expecting that they're going to be successful. All of these very well-funded expeditions have already taken off with well-known scientists, and the Roosevelts are not that, right? These are the sons of Teddy Roosevelt, who, of course, have a lot of experience in the wild. They have experience hunting, but they're not well known as scientists. And so really the fact that they were the ones to find the panda is very surprising.
Can you give us a sense of what got them interested in this? Because, you know, Kermit famously went with his father to the River of Doubt in that, you know, epic expedition that was very challenging and difficult. What was it that got them interested in doing this?
It's interesting you bring up the River of Doubt, because I think there are some real similarities there to the start of that expedition and the start of this one. So when Kermit and Teddy Roosevelt go on this exploration to the River of Doubt, it's right after Teddy Roosevelt has lost the election. He's at a real low place in his life when he decides to embark on this journey. And really, that's the same really thing that happens for his two eldest sons in 1928. They are really at a low point in their lives. We see that his oldest son, Ted Jr., has just been politically obliterated. He's been involved in scandals in Washington. He has no political future ahead of him. And his wife states that very baldly in her books and in her letters. And Kermit is also struggling. He has a business that's not doing well. He's having difficulty in his personal relationships. So when they decide to go on this expedition, they are in some ways looking for escape. But they are also searching for discovery. And you know, what we see in the Roosevelt family is that there is this real yearning to be in the wilderness, to go out exploring, to find animals, to find plants. It's really part of their family legacy. And so perhaps it's not a surprise that at a time in their lives when they're facing difficulty, they decide to do this, even though they don't believe they'll ultimately find the panda and be successful. And they say this so many times in their letters that they really don't believe they're ever going to find the panda. And certainly it's surprising when they do.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, thinking back on Theodore Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, in his early life, when he was going through some terrible struggles, you know, like you said, his inclination was to go out in the wild. And that's when he famously went out to the West and had the Elkhorn cattle ranch and all those adventures and misadventures before he came back and became, you know, the Teddy Roosevelt that we all know. It's interesting that they share that bond of when the things are not going well, let's go out in the wilds.
Absolutely. There's certainly a lot that they got from their father. And when I researched their relationship, what I found is that Teddy Roosevelt was a very affectionate father. He was the kind of dad that got down on the floor and played with his sons. He wrote them notes when he was away. He drew them little pictures. He told them very often how much he loved them. He's certainly not the archetype of what you would think a father would be at that period in history. But he could also be hard on them. And especially with Kermit, he would tell him that he was afraid he would grow up to be a weakling. And so on these adventures, when they're going out exploring, they talk about their dad so often in their journals and letters. He is very much present in their minds. And you can see that they're really trying to live up to his legacy on this trip.
Yeah, well, President Roosevelt himself, Teddy was famously worried about being a weakling and really pushed himself to not be that.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That's interesting. All right, tell us about the actual makeup of this expedition and its financing. Who backed this? Because the Roosevelts weren't that wealthy. And who were the people in the expedition? Because it's an interesting mix of folks.
It is. So the expedition was backed by the Field Museum in Chicago. And the members of the expedition were fairly small. So you had Sudham Cutting, who is a naturalist from New York. And you had Herbert Stevens, who is a scientist from the UK. And then you had Ty Jack Young, who was brought in as a translator, but also trained in scientific method at the Field Museum before the trip. And so he ends up becoming very important on the trip, not really for his language skills, which are very complex in this part of China, but because of his abilities in science. And I really enjoyed researching him because he is young. He is only 19 when this expedition starts. He is an NYU student that's kind of been brought into this expedition. He has such admiration for the Roosevelt brothers. And so he brings this real fresh set of eyes to the trip. And so for the book, I was able to obtain his unpublished autobiography, as well as some interviews that he'd given in the 1990s. And so I was able to get a lot of detail about what occurred on the expedition and what his feelings were on the trail, which just brings a lot to the trip. It gives a lot of details.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Natalia Holt, author of the new book, The Beast in the Clouds, The Roosevelt Brothers' Deadly Quest to Find the Mythical Giant Panda. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with author Natalia Holt about her new book, The Beast in the Clouds. It tells the story of President Theodore Roosevelt's two sons, Theodore Jr. and Kermit, and their 1928 expedition to the Himalaya in search of the giant panda. It's interesting to think about, you know, geographically, this is very different from the River of Doubt expedition in South America. Similarities to the hardships and difficulties, but it's a very different place. Can you just give us a sense of where they go? Yeah, because it's a very complex region.
It is, and especially because they travel so far. So this is all occurring in southwest China, and the expedition travels 1,000 miles in 5 months. So they are going from lush rainforests to Himalayas to being in the snow in the Himalayas and suffering from altitude sickness on some very high peaks, to then exploring the Tibetan plateau, and then finally being in these mountainous bamboo old growth forests. So they see so much of China. They go through so many different cultures. They're frequently straddling the border between Tibet and China. And at that time, there were so many cultures that lived in this part of China. So they're always meeting new people, new rulers, and being introduced to new ways of life on the trip. And so the people they meet along the way are very interesting as well.
Yeah, and I was not really aware of this but until I read your book, but it's very interesting that the story of Tibet and the Dalai Lama, that, you know, this was a time when Tibet had basically thrown the Chinese out of Tibet right before they came back. So it's an interesting, you know, what's going on that it's still going on there in Tibet, this clash between the Chinese and Tibetans.
Absolutely. And the Roosevelts were not quite prepared for this. They did not realize that they were walking into a civil war. And they literally walk into battle scenes along the trail. There are some very tense moments that occur, as well as some interesting ones, because they are visiting these autonomous regions of China, often ruled by Tibetans. And so we get to see areas where women have a lot of dominance in society. And in fact, along the trail, about half of the guides who are kind of, you know, they're given different names. Sometimes people call them porters. Sometimes people call them guides. They're sort of like the Sherpa people of Nepal in that they carry things along the trail. They help guide the way. They break the trail ahead of the explorers and they make camp. And so what I found to be very interesting is that about half of the guides were women. And so they just have a fascinating role in the book and what they're able to accomplish. There's one very dramatic story where a group of women guides are able to chase away some bandits that they meet on the trail. And this all happens before the Roosevelts even know what's going on. So there's certainly some exciting moments like that.
Yeah, I love that part. And conversely, there's a part of your book that I was aware of, but, you know, reading about it in your book made me just like, wow, that is just so alien to me, is the concept of foot binding. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I do go into the history of foot binding in the book, because although the practice had been recently banned in China, it was still happening in many of these remote regions where women's feet were literally broken in half when they're young so that they can fit in these small lotus shoes, which look just like a doll's shoes. And this practice keeps women, of course, from so many activities. And for many of these remote areas, it essentially keeps them in one place. They can't escape because there are no roads where the Roosevelts are traveling. They're all traveling by trail. So there's certainly no way out for many of these women. And so it was interesting to read Ted and Kermit's thoughts about foot binding as they're seeing it firsthand. They're seeing both all the posters that the Chinese government has put up that denounce foot binding and outlaw it, as well as the actual results of women who are hobbling down streets, unable to move because of what has been done to them when they were children.
Yeah, it's definitely a big yuck for me reading that. I was like, that's just horrible. I don't understand why anybody would, you know, want to do that to their daughter, have their mother be like that. It's just very alien to me. But it's also very interesting when you think about it. And in this kind of, you've mentioned this, but it goes throughout your book, is this, these culture clashes that the Roosevelts find themselves involved in, where these are very different kinds of people than what they're used to.
Absolutely. And what's interesting to me is how Ted and Kermit are able to make some close friends along the way. So on one of their stops, they meet with a man named Cheng Tali, who is the guardian of the eastern border. And so this is an autonomous region of China that is controlled by Tibetans. And they end up having this very interesting relationship where the ruler does not know who Teddy Roosevelt is. And so because of that, Ted and Kermit write about how free they feel when they're there. They feel like there's no expectations on them. It's so different than they felt in their previous travels. And they end up talking a lot about family, talking a lot about their history. And there's a real relationship that's formed there that was very touching to read about and to research.
Yes, it can really be a burden when your father or your mother are a very famous person, and you're expected to somehow live up to that.
Yes, we tend to think of all the advantages, which of course there are so many. Ted and Kermit had many advantages to be the son of a president and to be son of a man like Teddy Roosevelt, who is just such a larger than life figure in history. But there were disadvantages too, and we really see that in the book. We really see that in their stories about what they went through and how it felt to try to live up to that legacy and what they wanted from it.
One of the things that struck me is, just thinking about, I'm so lucky that I enjoy time in the outdoors. I like to go in the mountains. I love to be in the high country. But I have all this wonderful modern technology at my disposal. I've got fabrics that breathe and will dry almost instantly after they get wet. They are super insulating. All this great stuff. Back then in 1929, you know, they're exploring these really rugged parts of the Himalaya, these extreme climates and altitudes. And it's tough sledding, literally, at times.
Absolutely. It was very difficult to travel through this area, even with the many supplies they brought, which are being carried by mules. But what we see is that in the Himalayas, they end up having some very dangerous moments where there are huge snowstorms. The mules end up leaving in the middle of the night, so they have no supplies. And now they're isolated on this trail many, many miles from any town with no food, with no supplies, no idea what they're going to do, and then also suffering from altitude sickness. And so it's no wonder that we see they have some very difficult moments. In fact, there's one night that Ted calls the worst night of his life, where they become very close to death. They really believe they're going to die there on the trail. And it's sheer fortune that they were able to survive these moments. And of course, the hard work of all of the many guides and the many other people on the trail as well. They're during this one moment where they have this horrible night and they come very close to death and everyone is suffering from altitude sickness. They end up ultimately finding rescue with a lamasery. And so it's a group of Tibetan monks that live in, who are lamas, who live in this lamasery, who end up taking them in and feeding them, patching their clothes. So they get a lot of relief on the trail from unexpected people like this.
Yeah, that was a wonderful part of the story. Very harrowing. The mules disappearing was just like, oh no, how are they going to survive this?
And the fact that it happens twice, I couldn't even believe it myself. I was like, no, after the first time, surely you would be more careful.
You know, really, you know, let's have somebody watch the mules all night.
But it's, you can imagine that's tough to do. Yeah. They don't have a lot of options.
No. And like you said, it's also just very stark, difficult territory to be in, even when the weather's great. And when it's bad, it can be, you know, people die in places like that. So, I wonder, you know, it may or may not be connected, but the altitude sickness and what Theodore went through in particular, I wonder if that's what, you know, perhaps affected his heart that he wound up dying from some 20 years later.
That's interesting. I don't know if there's a connection there.
Just made me wonder.
Yeah.
So I hadn't thought about it before. I wonder if that, you know, because a lot of times the heart can be damaged under those situations. And, you know, back then they probably had no way of diagnosing and scanning and all that kind of stuff that we can do now.
Absolutely. And he was hiding his heart condition as well. So he really wasn't receiving treatment for it, which was probably a big part of the problem. Yeah. In addition.
And it's interesting. Tell me a bit about what you gleaned about the relationship of the brothers to each other. You talked a bit about them with her father, but how about each other? Did this expedition, you know, bring them closer together? What do you think? What's your sense of how it affected their relationship?
At first, the expedition brings them closer together. And what we see is that all of their journal entries and their letters are full of these happy exclamations of how fortunate they feel to be with their brother, how they don't feel like themselves unless they're with their brother in the woods. I mean, really, it's just remarkable how happy they are for much of this expedition, even during some very difficult moments. But they really loved being together. And even when the group is forced to separate at a few different places in the book, we see that the brothers always stay together. They never leave each other.
Yeah.
Things change once they find the panda. And this becomes a very difficult time for them because immediately they realize that the panda is not what they expected. This is not at all what they thought they were hunting. And it ends up changing their lives. And what we see is that their relationship suffers in the years ahead. They'll never be as close as they were on the trail.
Before the panda.
Yeah.
And let's talk a bit about the state of conservation and science back then, because it's always, you know, it's always easy for us in 2025 or whatever to look back at people who lived, you know, even just 30, 40 years ago, and their attitudes go, well, gosh, that's just unenlightened. And what's wrong with those people? But people are, you know, of their time, and times have different attitudes and mores. Back then, like when Theodore Roosevelt Sr. was doing a lot of his great conservation work, and they were doing this expedition in 1929, going out for a museum and collecting specimens was something you did, you know, in the name of science. But you're killing things and bringing them back.
Absolutely. This is how it was done. Photographs could not be relied on. Descriptions were not proof. The only way a museum could study an animal and then compare it to other animals to understand what it should be called, what family it's in, is this an endangered animal? The only way those things could happen, it was in a museum. And it was really how so much of the foundation of our understanding of biology happened. This is how it occurred, from specimens being brought into museums. And it's hard for us to imagine, but the thinking at the time was that if you have an animal that's endangered, nature has already made its choice. This animal is not going to survive. So the least we can do is hunt it, kill it, and have a record made of it. This obviously just seems crazy to us now, but this is really how people thought at the time. Even Darwin went out and hunted animals that were rare and endangered. And so it's not surprising that this is how scientists such as the Roosevelts were behaving at the time. What is surprising is what happens after they find the panda, because they are really expecting this panda to be a ferocious bear. They're expecting to find a predator. Because it's a black and white bear, they think it's going to be a mix of a polar bear and a black bear. And at one point, Ted says this is likely the most aggressive predator on Earth. Of course, that is not what they find.
Well, and it's understandable to think that, because polar bears and brown bears, you know, giant grizzly bears, are very fearsome creatures. And so, you know, it's understandable, especially since they don't know. Nobody in the West really knows what these animals are, what they look like, how big they are. They know nothing about them. But they do know that, you know, grizzly bears and polar bears are very scary.
That's right. And so because that's the basis of their information, they really don't have much else to go on. Now, that does change when they enter the region where they ultimately find the panda, because people living there tell them, they say, hey, this bear is not what you're thinking. It's not aggressive. It's not going to attack you. But they don't believe them. They still think that they are hunting this predator. And so when they find out that the panda is actually very gentle, it really shocks them and it really changes things for them. Because unlike their other expeditions where, you know, they had often planned to go back, and Kermit talked about maybe hunting another elephant one day, things like that, where they had often planned to go back to these sites of their expeditions and hunt again, the Roosevelts, although they receive many invitations to do so, never want to hunt another panda. And not only that, but they work actively to make sure that panda hunting is stopped in the future. Kermit Roosevelt in particular ends up really dedicating his life towards this. He ends up using his contacts in China to negotiate and legislate bills that will then protect pandas from Westerners coming in to hunt, and also cubs being stolen for Western zoos.
And when they bring the panda, they do kill a panda. When they bring that back to the United States, what do you think that the people that, you know, are getting this specimen, what are they thinking when the Roosevelts bring this back? Is this something that's like really very earth-changing for them as far as taxonomy and learning about bears and things? Or was it like, oh, okay?
Oh, they are elated. This is a very exciting time for them to receive this panda, because they're the only museum in the world that has a specimen like this with all of the bones, so they can compare the jaw, they can compare the length of everything as part of this. And it's very exciting for them. And not only that, but they also have all the descriptions from the Roosevelts about where the bear was found. They learned a lot about the panda's diet from the Roosevelts. And they're able to then go into all the morphology and relate that to taxonomy. And that, of course, is debated for many, many years, up until the 1980s, when genetic testing is finally able to determine that, yes, the giant panda is actually a bear. But, you know, these specimens end up being a big part of that debate. And it's interesting for scientists at that time to have real proof that this animal exists.
And as you said, Kermit, you know, kind of devotes himself to conservation issues. And it's very interesting to think about him pre-expedition and post-expedition. I believe, you know, he was like his dad one of the founders of the Boone and Crockett Club?
Yes.
Where they, you know, go out and collect these, you know, giant trophy animals for hunting and stuff. And if you kill a certain size animal, it's a Boone and Crockett record. And I remember reading something about Kermit that he was like an exemplary member of the Boone and Crockett Club. He was like everything that you'd want a Boone and Crockett Club member to be. And then, you know, after this, he goes through quite a metamorphosis. Could you talk about that a bit?
This was shocking to me how much he changed. And you see it right away in the writings from both Ted and Kermit, but especially Kermit, who immediately after they kill the panda expresses regret. And it's a difficult moment because they're bringing this panda back to the United States. It immediately gets acclaim. It's in all the newspapers. The Field Museum makes a big deal about this. And then the unintended consequences begin, where suddenly big game hunters are now going to China because they know exactly where the panda can be found. And then you also have these hunters who are going to steal cubs for American zoos. And the Roosevelts understand that they're the ones that have caused this, and their writings about this are just heartbreaking. They're very upset by what's happened. And so what we see is that Kermit ends up taking this position with the New York Zoological Society, and then with the Audubon Society, where he's president. And he really makes big changes in his life. He does an expedition to the Galapagos with another member, of the team. And this time, instead of killing endangered animals, they're actually trying to work out a plan that's a breeding program for the tortoises of the Galapagos to save them. And so all of their studies there are very different. They don't kill any animals on that trip. And then he does do some other interesting things. He calls for an end to duck hunting. He really writes, and he has this monthly column when he is head of the Audubon group, where he talks so much about how animals need to be protected. And many of his writings about the panda are particularly interesting because he's so passionate about stopping hunting and stopping the cubs that are being stolen. There's this one moment in the book where the two brothers are with the first panda cub that has been brought back to the United States, and it's being auctioned off for zoos.
And what year was that? Was that the 1930s?
Yeah, so this is 1938, so it's 10 years after the panda expedition. And it's been brought back by a woman named Ruth Harkness, who is this kind of an interesting figure. She's this wealthy socialite who sort of took up this cause after her husband passed away in China. And so the two brothers are with her in this hotel room, and there's a bunch of other people there. And Ted is holding this cub that, you know, has been stolen from the wilderness. And one of the men asks him, oh, maybe one day this panda will be stuffed and sit among your pandas in the field museum. And he says, I'd sooner stuff my own son. And he's angry. He writes about this later, about how upset he is that this cub has been taken. Ultimately, that cub does die young, as all of these early cubs do that are stolen and brought to the West. And it is stuffed and placed along the Roosevelt's expedition in Chicago. And I just found fascinating how much regret among the panda was experienced by every member of that expedition. They really had very deep feelings about what happened. Even Ruth Harkness, who stole multiple cubs from China, ends up feeling regret in the end and returns one of those cubs back to China.
After a short break, we'll be back for more as we visit with author Natalia Holt about her new book, The Beast in the Clouds, The Roosevelt Brothers' Deadly Quest to Find the Mythical Giant Panda. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we look back at the late 1920s Himalayan expedition to search for the giant panda, which was led by Theodore Roosevelt Jr. and his brother Kermit. And it's interesting to think about, you know, in my lifetime, how pandas have become such an iconic part of our relationship with China and panda diplomacy and, you know, Ling Ling, and the story of the pandas in America and China is—it's really a kind of an interesting one with this incredible connection back to the Roosevelts.
That's right. If the Roosevelts hadn't had this big discovery, if there hadn't been this fanfare, we would never have had the same relationship with pandas. It really started this pandemonium where people were so excited about pandas. Suddenly, pandas were everywhere in the United States during that time. And it's really thanks to them for introducing the pandas to the West.
Tell us a bit more, for people who haven't read the book, but hopefully will, about where the pandas live, because they live in this really interesting environment.
They do. So they live in just a few. I think there are six mountainous regions in China where pandas can be found. And these are small, fragmented areas. They prefer old growth bamboo forest. And what's interesting is that since protections have been put in place to protect these forests for the pandas, it has benefited other species that also live in these woods. So there's certainly been a lot of impact from the panda. And of course, the panda is really seen as a symbol of conservation biology. So the fact that you had the panda receive some of the very earliest protections for any endangered animal has had this enormous influence among biology in general.
Yeah, it's like when I hear, when I think of like the World Wildlife Federation, the image that comes to my mind is a panda.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, what about like now? What are some of the, I don't know if this is something you really got into, but what are some of the conservation issues that, you know, are going on with pandas now, the challenges they're facing? Because they really are a very fragile species.
They are. There's fewer than 2,000 pandas in the wild. It's actually gotten better since the 1980s. There used to be far fewer pandas. So things have improved, but certainly there's a lot of work to do. But we also have many pandas that are in captivity. And so there are quite a few biologists and naturalists who worry about the breeding programs that we have in zoos today and feel that ultimately they are not good for the species. They're great for people who love pandas and love to see pandas in zoos, which is wonderful. But for the animals themselves, that focus should really be put on the preserves themselves and making wild places available for pandas. And so there's been a real focus on how we can expand those preserves, how we can maybe even connect them so that there is more interaction. Pandas are a very solitary animal. They don't really interact much at all. Most of their communication is done through rubbing on trees and pushing their scent throughout bamboo forests. And so that really needs quite a bit of space. That means that pandas need a lot of space to be solitary, but they also need connections to be able to find one another. And so I think through efforts like that, it can not only benefit the panda, but so many other species that live in China.
Let's talk a bit about the aftermath of the expedition, and we'll finish up with the brothers. But tell us about what happened to some of the key members of the expedition after.
So after the expedition, what we see is that Sudum Cutting, who is this naturalist from New York, ends up working with Kermit Roosevelt, and they go to the Galapagos, and they do a big effort to preserve the Galapagos tortoise that lives there and many of the other species. He ends up returning to Tibet and has this very long history where he visits the Dalai Lama, he exchanges gifts, and instead of looking for animals and hunting, he ends up becoming really interested in the culture. And so that's a piece of the history that Sudum Cutting is able to bring back to the West, where he's able to introduce a lot of Westerners to Tibetan culture in a way that they hadn't been introduced to it before. And it's really what he's best known for. You also then have Herbert Stevens, who is the British naturalist, who is such a interesting person. He's kind of a funny character in the book because he's sort of the slow prodding scientist that doesn't want to be rushed, who always wants to take his time. He has had a lot of difficulty gaining recognition in his field, and it's really this expedition that turns things around for him. He's able to publish articles based on his work and really gain recognition in the field. And then you have Taijak Young, who has such a fascinating history. It would be hard for me to even tell a small piece of it, except to say that he does end up returning to China. He ends up going on another panda expedition. He's the only one of the group to do so, but feels quite a lot of regret about it. And so what we see is that he ends up being drawn into World War II, as do Ted and Kermit, and ends up becoming this amazing hero who wins many medals, becomes a very prominent member of the U.S. Army, and plays a role in all kinds of missions during World War II.
He's one of the most fascinating characters in the whole story to me.
I think so too. Yeah, he just has so much of what happened to him after the expedition is really fascinating that I wish I could
induce another writer to write
about him.
So very young when he went on this expedition. It's like almost hard to fathom.
It is. And I think what's interesting is that he and Ted and Kermit stayed close friends throughout the rest of their lives. They would meet together. It was not a cursory friendship. There were many letters exchanged back and forth. And in fact, Ted, Kermit, and Sudum all funded an expedition for Jack so that he could return to China and become a scientist, which was really his dream. It ends up becoming different than he expected because of World War II. But certainly Jack's history is worthy of a whole nother book.
Yes. And of course, the Roosevelt brothers both die during World War II. Which is, you know, kind of the sad legacy there. But what was your takeaway from how each of them passed? Because one was very tragic. They're both tragic, but one was extremely tragic.
Yes, it really is. Probably many people are familiar with the end of Ted's story because he was the first general to land on the beaches of Normandy.
And the oldest person.
The eldest. He was there with a cane on the beaches of Normandy. Mm-hmm. And he yelled, "We'll start the war from right here." He was really known to be an inspiration to so many of the soldiers around him. And he died of a heart attack shortly after that day. But what an incredible legacy. Certainly amazing what he was able to accomplish in World War II at his age. I mean, the fact that both Ted and Kermit signed up and insisted on being part of World War II before the U.S. even got involved says so much about them and says so much about the Roosevelt legacy that they did that. Sadly, Kermit's story is very tragic because he was very depressed and he ends up killing himself in army barracks in Alaska during World War II. And there's a quote from his brother where he says he really died 5 years ago. And I just found this so difficult to read because certainly Kermit's life was very difficult after the panda. You know, he has these great moments of redemption where you can tell he wanted to do so much more for the panda. He had so many goals after that expedition, and certainly his life took a very different turn. And in some ways you can say, oh, well, what they did was terrible. They killed a panda. In some ways you might feel like he deserved for many of these horrible things to happen. But he does have some really stirring moments of redemption. And it was moving to see how much he did change his life after that expedition. And it's sad that he was still struggling with depression throughout his life.
Yeah, it really is a sad, tragic story, Kermit's story. And but what an incredible tale this is that you've woven about this expedition that I had no idea about. And it's a great read. It's, you know, it's full of action and adventure and different kinds of people. It's a really cool read. And kind of my last question for you is, when I read a book, especially if it's like a biography or a memoir, and I'm really absorbed in it, like I was with this book, and you get to know these people and you're reading about them and they're important to you, and you grow to, you know, fond of them in a way. And then you get to the end of the book as a reader and it's like, oh, I'm going to miss these people. This is over for me. You know, it's like, maybe I'll reread this in a few years or something, but it's over. That's kind of that sad moment when that was a really good book, but oh, darn, now it's over. I'm wondering what that's like for a writer when you complete a project. Is there something analogous? Because you spend way more time with them than the reader does.
I think that's true. There is a sadness that happens when I finish a book. It's tough. You spend so many years with these characters who are real people and who you come to know as a real person. I suppose it was easier with Rocket Girls because I could still call Barbara. I can always chat with her. And in this case, of course, I can't do that. But it's certainly the biggest compliment a book could get is that you miss the characters and that you miss being part of the story. And I've certainly experienced that with all my books. I've become very attached.
It's funny. After I'd finished your book, there was the movie The Longest Day, which was from the early 1960s, about D-Day, happened to be on TV, and I was watching. It was right at the scene where Henry Fonda, the great actor, is playing Theodore Jr. in the film. Mm-hmm. And he's masking his problems, his physical problems, to the guy who doesn't want him, to the commander, doesn't want him on the beach. And he said, "Yeah, I got to be there with my troops. I trained with them. They expect me there." And I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, I was just reading about you. This is kind of a very cool, you know, moment where it just happened to be on at that time. And I thought about your book.
That is fun. It's, you know, it's been nice for me as well to connect with the Roosevelt family.
They're real people, not, you know, as wonderful as fiction is, you know, and characters. These are real people that had real lives.
Yes, it's good to remember that. They're not just part of this story. They had long, rich lives. And there's been some wonderful biographies written about Ted. There hasn't been as much written about Kermit, but it's great to be able to share this one little slice of their lives because I think it tells you a lot about them and who they were as people. And I found that as I've talked with members of the Roosevelt family, they've been very thankful for that as well, to have this part of their lives explored and to be shown, because it just says how much, how, you know, how real they were and how much they cared about what they did.
Oh, that's wonderful. And now that you've finished this book, how long does it usually take you before you start to get your mind starting to turn in a new direction? Has that already happened for you, where you're, maybe this is the next one?
Yes. No, I always have something kind of brewing and things, you know, topics that I'm thinking about. You know, it's still early for me. I'm still in that period of trying to decide if I'm going to devote years to it. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, it's quite an investment. Well, I'm hoping you will find something as fascinating as all your other books have been, and look forward to that in the future. Natalia Holt, it's been wonderful to have you on the show and to talk about this great book, The Beast in the Clouds, The Roosevelt Brothers' Deadly Quest to Find the Mythical Giant Panda. It was just great to have you on, and I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to our guest, Natalia Holt. You can find her new book, The Beast in the Clouds, The Roosevelt Brothers' Deadly Quest to Find the Mythical Giant Panda, at most major booksellers, or order it at your local bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.